obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Bill, alcoholic. Who's that bald guy? And why won't he look at me? It's a little weird, don't you think? I spoke at a convention in Minneapolis, and they had this up there, and they told us that it was piped into all the rooms. And this is a huge hotel, right? And so I was the Saturday night guy, I think, and I got up there and I said, for all you people in your hotel rooms, if you're naked watching me, you have issues. I'd like to thank Jeff and the committee for asking us to come down here. San Diego is such a nice place. Last place my wife and I were at speaking at an AA thing was in Iceland. The last day we were there, it was hailing sideways. This is not good for Southern California people, you know. This is much nicer. This is a beautiful hotel, too, by the way. This is a nice place to have this. Hope you can afford it. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. You know? I see there's some other phonies in the room. I'm a child of the 60s. I graduated from high school in 1965. You'll hear people in AA say, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drunk. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. I'm pretty sure it was really interesting. You know, I've been told. And the road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. They weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel. You know, and young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. You have to remember, you have to think back, they were burning their bras. And some people say there's no God. It's a very special time. Every decade since has wanted to be the 60s, you know. And I'm sorry I missed the damn thing. It was really interesting. I graduated from high school in 65, and by the time I was 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I'd already been to jail. I was in trouble. I had the slouch. I had the sneer. I had the big jacket. I had the attitude and the foul mouth. I had a bit of a problem with authority, you know, and if you had some, I didn't like you, and I was not quiet and shy about it, and it got me in a lot of trouble, and by the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. Now, what, I needed a rest. It's difficult straightening out all the authority figures, you know. It's hard work. And wasn't the whole idea behind this drinking thing to have a party? Wasn't that the idea? I mean, the idea to me was to have, you hear everybody talks about it. Every speaker, every person in AA talks about how they felt like they were not part of and they were aliens dropped off and they didn't relate to their parents, they didn't belong here. And then they had a couple of drinks and everything mellowed out and they got better looking. And everybody has their way of telling that story about how the alcohol relaxed them. Some people actually even say it saved their lives. They were so screwed up that if they hadn't had alcohol around, they might have offed themselves. So it helped. And the way it helped is it helped us to be more social. The idea was to get out of the house and go to the party and have some adventures and meet her, get lucky, and you never know. Have a good time. I don't know about you, I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television taking notes. Party! I mean, we're having sex menage a uno. There's no one else in the room. You know? It's like when new people come into AA, you know, they say, well, I'm just a party kind of guy. I go, how many other people were at the party? Another common thread that runs through our story, we have a tendency to end up completely alone, physically completely alone somewhere. I mean, yeah, even in a group of people, we can feel detached, but we also end up all alone. Nobody else, nobody's knocking on my door going, can Billy come out and play? When I was 6 years old, my dad got sober, got fired from a job. And he came home rather than go to the bar. And I think it was probably my mother that called AA. And he went to an AA meeting that night in Inglewood, California, on Western Avenue, a clubhouse there. And he came back from that meeting and he told my mother, he says, you know, those people have got something down there and I'm going to go find out what it is. So the next night she went down there with him in order to monitor the situation. Make sure he signed the papers and talked to the right people, paid the dues. And they go walking in there, and this woman sees my mother there and hustles right up to her and asks her what she's doing there. She says, I'm here to make sure he signs the paper. And this woman took my mother into the other room. When my father died in 1999, he was 45 years sober. And when my mother passed in 2002, she was 48 years in Al-Anon. So I grew up in one of those horrible AA houses. I don't recommend it. There's nothing worse than living with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head. You know, you're going around the corner to smoke one, and they're waiting for you going, where are you going? It was hell. I had all these, if anybody else has been raised in an AA house, you have these weird uncles around, you know. I'd come home and one of the weird uncles would be laying on the back porch waiting for their sponsor to come home. And I'd get him up and drag him in the house. One day I came home, there was a woman hiding in the garage. That was the Al-Anon. Don't make Al-Anon jokes if you don't know what it is. But if you know what it is, you can make some great Al-Anon jokes. Just stop and think of the consciousness of an individual that would live with us on purpose. What are they thinking? Oh, this will be fun, you know. Kind of like rebuilding an old car or something. You know. So I grew up in this house, and this was before the hospitals had figured out how to make money out of us, so when you went on a 12-step call, you brought them home. And I have a lot of memories of drunks around the house in varying degrees of sobriety, potlucks, barbecues, planning meetings. Now I know why we were always in goddamn Bakersfield. This is a Southern California convention. I mean, there's no good reason to go to Bakersfield, really, you know. And my parents were very active and stayed that way for, you know, most of the time. When my dad died, before he got ill, he was going to two meetings a week, one of which he took over so that it would be run correctly. You know, he was very active. He loved AA. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. So did my mother. And I'm a living example that self-knowledge as a treatment for alcoholism is pretty much worthless. I mean, I was 13 years, and one of the weird uncles was this man named Harold. And Harold just couldn't get sober. And my dad used to give him jobs around the house. You know, he was a cabinet maker, but he would give him, my dad would have him do projects so he could give him money. And he gave him, you know, put clothes on him and drove him to meetings and kind of took care of him, you know. And Harold finally got sober and he met a woman in AA. And I went to the wedding when they got married. And, you know, he got a job and he got a car and he was looking good. And Harold was just a nice man. He was just a really nice, sweet guy. And then he got drunk, and then he got divorced, and I went to the funeral when he burned himself up alive, smoking, in bed, drunk, in a hotel. And when I was 13 years old, when he died, I knew the reason he died is because he drank, not because he was smoking. I knew he died because he drank. I was clear about that. I knew that you weren't supposed to drink. Drinking was bad. Drinking hurt people. I'd sit out in the kitchens of AA meetings with the other AA kids, and we would talk about it and stuff, you know. My parents never sent me to Alateen. They didn't want me to learn how to drink and use, and that was their opinion, you know. My mother sent me to my first psychiatrist when I was 13 years old. I wasn't angry, I had rage. Anger can be an appropriate emotional response to a negative situation. Rage, on the other hand, is an old buddy. I mean, you can get off on rage. There's some seats right up here, ladies and gentlemen. There's plenty of room, just, you know, scoot some people over. This is my friend John and Donna. Hi. Why are you late? Where was I? Oh, rage. Yeah. Thank you. I'm the kind of kid, I was a kid then, I was the kind of kid up until my adult years where I would double over, fall on the floor, and the bile from my stomach would come up in my throat, my veins in my neck throbbing, eyes bulging, fist into the wall, head into the wall, just rage, just pissed off at the injustice of it all. And I can remember this, like being somewhere and just throwing myself down on the ground, you know, just like pissed off, you know. Where that came from, I don't know. My parents never beat me. Nobody molested me. Nothing like that happened in my life. I just was pissed. I think it just comes, it's probably the aliens, when they drop you off, they inject you with something, you know, and I just had rage for no apparent good reason, and I carried that with me into my adult life, into sobriety, I carried that. When it was my turn to drink, I did it with a vengeance. I was 15 years old, maybe 14, 15, and got a hold of some liquor, me and another guy, and we choked it down, and I caused some trouble at a party, and they threw me in a car and dropped me off on the front lawn of my house. I crawled in the house, and I crawled down to the bedroom, laying on the bed with one foot on the floor to stop the spinning. And back in those days, we used to have these big plastic things called records. They're great big black things with a hole in the middle. And we played them on pieces of furniture called record players. And some of these pieces of furniture had a lid on them. So I puked in the record player. It's hard to do that with a CD player. And but, you know, I wanted to hide the puke. I didn't want to get caught. I'm not drunk. I'm not stupid, you know. And I crawled down the hallway down into the bathroom, and I'm sitting on the toilet, and I had a trash can between my legs because it's coming out both ends by this time. And the door to the bathroom opens up, and I look up through the tears running down in my eyes. I see my mother standing there with this aghast expression on her face, and my dad standing behind her laughing hysterically, you know. I think he related. We connected, you know. And both of them in their own way were, oh, my God, it begins. And it began. I never crossed a line. I never knew there was a line. I'm the kind of guy that drinks for the blackout. I want to go away. I want to get out of this time zone. I don't like this reality. And I want to do it as often and as frequently as humanly possible. when I went to that shrink to deal with the rage, the shrink helped me. But the primary thing he did for me is he introduced me to my favorite subject, me. That never-ending search for self. It just, you ever notice how it just goes on and on? And I am limitless, you know. It just, it goes on forever. And by the time I was 22, when I was in that mental institution, I had gotten married. I met her at Bass Lake. We went to Oregon to grow our own. And we had two children. I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang, and I'm sticking needles in my arm every day and drinking like a fish and smoking anything within reach. And I end up in a mental institution. I'm not coming home to that family. They're on welfare. We lost the house. I lost several jobs. I lost a couple of cars. I lost everything, and I'm in a mental institution. And the way you end up in a mental institution is that it's not because you had a bad week. You have to build up a certain level of toxicity to qualify for the mental institution, you know. And somebody related. Anybody else here been in a mental institution? Oh, come on. I know there's a bunch of you out there saying, well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me. You know. How can you be in a room like this with a bunch of, and a few little hands go up, you know? Only those of us that have been in the mental institution know that it's not that bad. You have some sparkling conversations in the mental institution. You know, it's a great place to look for a bride. I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Karen. Just for the CD, I did not find her in the mental institution. You know, she has people come up to her now and say, did you guys meet in the nut house, you know? So I lost that family. I'm 22 and I lost that family. I also have to remember the way I ended up in the mental institution the first time is I called the police on myself. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's sometimes a controversy. Matter of fact, there really are no issues in AA, so we have to keep recycling the old ones over and over. And one of the big issues that gets recycled is the whole alcoholic addict thing. Are they the same? Is it different? Why is there separate programs? How does, you know, the whole controversy. Well, here's an operational definition of the difference between an alcoholic and a drug addict, because anybody that's been out on the street knows there's a difference between the two. No self-respecting drug addict would ever call the police on himself. But an alcoholic will do it and think it's a pretty good idea. There is a level of lameness in the alcoholic that simply does not exist in the hip, contemporary rock and roll drug addict of today. All those in favor? I'll call New York. So I come back down to Los Angeles. Now, I hated my father, which is one of the requirements for being an alcoholic. You have to hate your parents. People come to me and say they don't hate their parents. I go, you have some drinking to do. Either that or some thinking, something, you know. I mean, you're stuffing something, because you can't. For the alcoholic life to seem like the only normal one, like it talks about, how do we pull that off? It does, because you ask a guy, like you're sitting there, did your alcoholic life seem normal? And they'll look right at you and go, oh, yeah. How's that possible? How can an alcoholic life seem normal? When does it become okay to throw up on your friends? You know? When do you get used to that part? You know? I had a wonderful experience one time of driving a Volkswagen, and the old Volkswagens didn't have windows that rolled down in the back. So the guy in the back leaned over my shoulder to puke out the window. And that's when you catch yourself later cleaning it up with the guy, and you're laughing. You think, oh, that was fun. You know? When does that become okay? hitting on the neighbor's wife, you know. You ever know alcoholics are always getting busted for like flashing or being lewd in public? And you know what it is. They just didn't know where they were and they had to pee. You know, you can always tell when there's an alcoholic involved in a crime when it's an attempted crime. You know, he attempted to rob the liquor store, but he needed a nap right in the middle of it, you know. He tried to drive away, but he couldn't drive a stick shift, you know. Like, you know, alcoholics are just so hip. Matthew and I have a mutual friend that robbed 36 banks in the San Fernando Valley. He was fairly successful. And you ask him, you know, well, how did you screw up? He goes, well, the way I screwed up was 36. I should have stuck with 35, you know. But, you know, he just couldn't stop himself, you know. And, where the hell was I? So I come back down to Los Angeles. You can hate your parents, but when you need something, you can overlook certain things. You know, and I needed something. And my father let me sleep in his garage, and he gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo. And I tried to get normal. And an alcoholic of my variety can never be alone. So I found another volunteer. And we set up housekeeping together. Because you see, I'm a pretty high-maintenance guy. It's a group effort getting me through life. It takes a village, you know. And it's still that way today, you know. I mean, I don't take good care of myself alone. I need lots of people around me because it's a kind of it's a challenge getting me from one day to the next. And you can find volunteers out there. They're willing to take on your case. And I found this woman, and we set up housekeeping, and we had two more children. And the way you get normal is that you can't find anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. You pretty much have to stop doing that stuff, you know. And you can't take acid anymore because you got to talk to people. And it really isn't conducive to two-way conversation. You can have great one-way conversations, but two-way conversations require some form of sobriety. So what you do, what sober is you only drink on the weekends and you smoke pot during the week. And the reason that you can't drink during the week, because regular people have jobs. And when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. When I drink, everything stops. My life stopped, essentially, for 20 years. I didn't do anything. I didn't go anywhere. I didn't accomplish anything. Well, you got married two times and had some kids. You don't really, that doesn't take a lot of effort, you know? I mean, it's not like a goal you shoot for. I mean, it just sort of happened to me. You know, alcoholics of my variety end up with women they end up with, the ones that will take them on, because I don't have enough self-worth to actually walk up to you and talk to you and ask you to go anywhere with me. But if you happen to be sitting in the same room and we're loaded together, I'll sleep with you. You know, I'm pretty easy, you know. And then it seems like since we did that, well, let's get married. What the hell? And so nothing happened in my life. So I tried to do this normal thing, you know, just try to get to work. And I tried that experiment for 15 years. And as you can imagine, it failed miserably. I'm 37 years old. I'm married again. I've got two more small children. I live in the house with these people. And I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I did not know that. I didn't know it was that bad. The eye can't see itself. I can't stand outside of my own life and judge it or evaluate it based upon some other paradigm. I can't do that. I figure everybody else pretty much feels the same way. How would I know any different? So I had no idea that I wasn't connected. I'd never been connected to be able to determine what disconnected felt like. I didn't know that I'd never been close to anybody in my life. I always remembered my small childhood like I was really close with kids. And I think back on it now, that is not the case. I think other people were really close. I don't think I was. I had one more drunk so far, the last one, in March of 1985. And I came home this morning. I mean, I stayed up all night. I closed a bar. went driving around, went by my old high school, and you know how we get kind of maudlin and you know, did one of those things. And I actually said to this guy that was in the car with me, I actually said the words, "I can't live like this anymore." I said that out loud. I don't know that I'd ever said that. I mean, every one of us at some point in time, every single one of us at some point in time has gotten up, usually in the morning after an especially difficult evening the night before, and looked in the mirror and said or thought something along these lines as you look at yourself and you think, "I gotta cut this shit out." That's a moment of clarity, supplanted by the next thought being, "I need a drink." Because you can't really imagine living without it. You know you need to quit, but you can't imagine quitting. And how do you do that? How do you not drink? But this particular morning I came home, and I'm in the wrong place again, you know. I mean, I'm not going to make it to work. The paper hits the porch. The sun's coming up, and you can't blot out the sunlight. And you know it's going to be another miserable day. Just another horrible, painful day. And I just really couldn't stand it. I think I was afraid I was going to die. I think that there was some fear of death in me. And I called my mother. Like any good gangster, I called Mom. Next time you see a real tough-looking guy come into Alcoholics Anonymous, ask him if he lives with Mom. Most of them do. And they bitch about her, too. You know, that's real cute, isn't it? She doesn't understand. You're 47 years old. Funny, but true. And my mother came and she silently got me. She loaded me up in the car and she took me out and we checked me into a place called Starting Point in Costa Mesa. And she also drove me to the mental institution. She flew up to Oregon and drove me to the mental institution. Then she drove me. And I used to always say, I bet you that was a real sad day in her life. And this Al-Anon woman said to me not too long ago, she says, "You know, Bill, that probably wasn't that sad. When she drove you up there, she knew you were safe. You know, what's really frightening is knowing that you're out there and that you don't know where you are and what you're doing." I never considered that. I don't think about the other side very much, you know. So the day I called her for help, I'm sure that maybe that was a high point in her life when she was able to check me and maybe he's ready. Maybe this is going to work for him now. She told me, she says, she always knew that I would get sober. And I couldn't imagine, how do you know that? What makes you think that we're going to get sober? You know, I've got two kids up in Oregon that are 40 years old and both of them are pretty much on the street. One of them literally is on the street and he's a pretty bad heroin addict. And here comes my sponsor. "How come you're late?"
"There were so many people coming to try and see you."
Jeez. Now I have to tell the truth. Anyway, we checked me in this place. Now, she sent me to my first shrink when I was 13. I've been to the mental institution a couple of times. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other shrinks and psychiatrists. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. I know more about myself than is safe to know. But it's my favorite subject, you know. And so they checked me in this hospital. I could not imagine just coming to AA and not drinking. You know, and I'd seen Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew you weren't a bunch of old people just hanging on to each other. You know, I knew I'd seen the laughter and I heard the jokes and met all the guys, but I still could not imagine just sitting here and not drinking. I just couldn't imagine. I need to be put away. That's my MO. I need a rest. I need to go away for a while and kind of recoup and lose some weight and flush out my system, you know. So I checked myself in this place. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. It was, we had to make the sign. We made it in crafts, you know. A little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. I used to help people do their inventory and stuff. It's pathetic. And I remember after I got out of there, I told my sponsor, I said, "They want to make me a facilitator for aftercare." And he laughed and walked away from me. He said, "Stay away from those people." Those, you know. And so 35 days after 35 days, then what do? They let us out. Go forth, multiply, you know. And they let us out like we're okay, you know. And where do we end up? Linoleum floors and metal folding chairs for the rest of our natural lives. The world's aftercare program, AA. There are no referrals from Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no place you go where you walk in there and you say, "AA sent me here." That place doesn't exist. This is it. We've got to somehow make this work. And it's pretty bizarre. It's a bizarre place. It's the character defect center of the known universe. You know, the fellowship is something to be survived. You're guaranteed to piss me off. You know, you'll borrow money from me and you won't pay me back. You'll hit on my wife. You know, I'll give you a job. You'll do a shitty job, and somehow it'll be my fault. That's my personal favorite. You know. And then the coup de grace is that you won't show up to my birthday party after all I've done for you. You know? So if all I have is you, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. You know? So I come in and I ask this guy for help. After a while, I asked a man, I walked up to a guy and I said, "I need some help." And he said, "Be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock and read the doctor's opinion. Make notes in the margin about what you agree with and what you don't." And I did that. I did my homework assignment, and I showed up to his house, and he didn't trust me that I had read it, and he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. And I had lots of notes in the margin. I mean, I was beaten up, but I still had opinions. And we talked about those things. And he explained to me that his job as my sponsor is to guide me through the process of the 12 steps so that I might have some form of a spiritual awakening and a psychic change. I'll find a God of my understanding that will then solve my problems for me. That was his job. And he said, "I'd be more than happy to talk to you about what you think your problems are so that you will not share about them in the meetings." I didn't know any different. I just believed him, you know, and so I did what he told me. You know, and what I understand about that today, after some years of being around and going to God knows how many meetings and participating in AA at several different levels, I think the people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous and share what their day is like when they're in AA meetings don't have sponsors. The meeting becomes their sponsor. The meeting is the place where they go to find the healing. And they have fallen victim to the idea that going to lots of meetings is doing AA. And I don't think that's true.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I think the meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how your day went. And if I have a sponsor that I actually communicate with, that I get together with on a regular basis alone without other people around, I can talk to that individual about what's going on in my life, the problems I'm having with my wife or my children or my job or my financial problems or any number of things. It's a safe place, Alcoholics Anonymous. You talk about anything you want. The other fallacy that I think is a fallacy is when you hear people say that we're not a lending institution, we're not an employment agency, we're not a taxi service. That's simply not true. I think we're all those things. I personally won't lend you money because you never, ever pay me back. But I've learned from experience. I'll give you money, but I try to stay out of being your debtor. I don't want that to muddy our relationship. You know, if I sponsor you, I probably won't give you anything. You know, but I'll drive you places. I'll help you find a job. Why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I help you find a job if you need a job? I mean, we're an Alcoholics Anonymous. There is every kind of independent contractor known to man in AA. We're such horrible employees, we can't work for anybody. We're all entrepreneurs, you know, and we're all looking for cheap labor, you know. So I can help you find a job. I can probably help you get a place where you can get some money, put some money in your pocket, you know. Why wouldn't I do that? And that's what I saw my sponsor do. What he did is he invited me into his life. He said, yeah, come. The very first time we met in his house. He didn't even know my last name, never asked me. Wasn't interested, you know. I've come to find out that this is not a self-help group. It's not a support group, you know. It's not therapy. It's spiritual by its very nature. It's spiritual. And recovery, by its very nature, is uncomfortable. The most spiritual thing you'll ever hear in AA is, get in the car. That's the most spiritual thing you hear. You want to change your life? Get in the car. Don't ask where you're going. Just get in the car. And you'll end up some weird place that you'll be uncomfortable in. You won't know the rules, you won't know how to talk right, you won't be in charge, and you won't be the center of attention, and you won't like any of those things. That's where I found myself a lot, is in weird places with weird people, having experiences that I would never choose to have on my own. I think that's called a new life. When they come up and ask us for help, what are they asking for? I don't know that they know for sure either. You know, I don't know that I knew when I asked for help. I'm not clear on what it was I was looking for. I was afraid I was going to drink. I suppose, that I was going to go back to that old life. And I was afraid of that old life now. It was very empty and unfulfilling. I was starting to realize that I wasn't close to anybody. I couldn't feel anybody in my life. Have you ever had anybody say to you, you're not emotionally available for me? Usually you hear that in family group. You know what they mean by that? What they mean by that is I've got something that they want and I'm withholding it. The truth is worse. I don't have it. And what's worse than that is I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it, and I'm helping you look for it. And this is going to go on for a long time, you know, a long time. If you want me to be emotionally available for you, if you want me to be capable of intimacy, now that I'm sober, it's going to take about 10 years. I believe what happened to us when we were growing up is that we drank through puberty and we missed it. When the lessons were being learned, we were medicated. And we were so self-obsessed, we learned nothing from these things, even the ones that we went through. So now we're in AA, and now we're, in my case, almost 40 years old. I'm going to grow up now. And there's no way to speed that process up, but I can definitely slow it down. I can pick and choose what I will and won't do with this keen instrument that has served me so well to determine what is good for me and what's not. I mean, its track record is stunning, you know? And I'm going to continue to use that. And there's people in AA that will help me use that. They will help me. They will cheer me on to pick and choose what I will and won't do. They'll say incredibly dangerous things like, take what you can use and leave the rest. Now, just repeat that a couple of times. Doesn't it just sound wrong? Take what you can use and leave the rest. That's a definition for the way I lived my life. I took what I wanted. I took what was cute. I took what was easy. I took what was belonged to you. And anything that made me uncomfortable, that I felt a little bit uncomfortable about, I would just leave it. No, I don't want to do that. Now, I'm going to come into AA and do the same thing when what I'm asking you for is a new life, and you're offering me the new life, and I'm going to turn you down. No, I don't do that. Thank you very much. You know, but I thought you wanted a new life. Well, yeah, I do, but not that way. You know, well, what way would you like it? Well, I'm not really clear on that, but I know that I don't want to go to that prison and talk to those people. You know, I know that I don't want to do this. I know that I don't. There's always something. There's always some good reason. And you can find support for that reason, and nothing will change. Now, if it's truly going to take me 10 years of 10 years worth of experiences to start to grow up now, I'll promise you something. If all you and I do is go to meetings for 10 years, nothing will change. Absolutely nothing. Nothing will change. It'll be just the way it was. You might show up for work a little bit more regularly, but probably not that well because you'll be so hard to get along with, it'll be difficult for you to maintain employment because you'll never grow up. You will continue to be infantile and take things personal that aren't. And it's really hard to be a good employee and do that kind of stuff, you know, because that's the way kids are. My 15-year-old son said to me, he's 22 now, but he said to me one day, I walked up to him and I said, how are you and Brittany getting along? And he says, well, we broke up. And I go, really, what happened? He says, well, Dad, you know how you go up to a girl and you tell her that you don't love her so you can see what kind of reaction you get back from her to determine whether she loves you or not? I looked right at him and lied and I went, yeah, I know, yeah. And he says, well, I said that to her, and she said, okay, and left. He goes, I'm never going to do that again. And there's a couple of really bizarre things about that conversation. One is he actually told me the truth, which is pretty stunning. I would have never said anything like I don't think I could have analyzed it well enough to say it anyway, to have that conversation. And the other thing is that he learned from the experiences. He admitted his error. I think he's growing up. I think you and I missed all that part. We didn't learn those social skills. So now, if in 10 years, if I'm going to meetings, if I've got a sponsor, if I'm working the steps, if I really work those steps and I look at the first step and I say, and I'm taught, more is correct, that I am powerless over alcohol and pretty much everything else. As time goes by, you come to realize the depth of that statement, of that concept of powerlessness. And as a second separate thought, my life is unmanageable. This is good news. This is not bad news. Some people say the first step means that we're screwed. I don't think so. I think we've been freed. I no longer have to do the job of managing my life. I've done it so miserably. They're telling me now that I don't have to manage it anymore. If I can grasp those things, the second step becomes operational. If it's true that I can't manage it and I'm powerless, then I need something to enter into my life that will take over that management position. That's some pretty profound stuff. I mean, we say it all the time in the rooms. We repeat it But you stop and think about that. Really giving up. Really giving up. Really understanding at depth that I truly, honestly, in reality, cannot manage my life. And I'm powerless over pretty much everything else around me. That is a complete and total position of acceptance. There's no other place to go to. And that this power is going to enter in my life and take over that job and restore me to sanity, enough sanity not to pick up a drink or not to medicate that feeling of powerlessness and unmanageability. Then the third step becomes operational. Well, what do? You turn your life and your will over to it. What else? Well, that's what you do. He's got to manage something. Let's give him the whole goddamn thing. What life and will? The fourth step becomes operational. The resentments, the fears, the broken relationships, everything that got me here, my life, my will, resentments, fears, broken relationships. When an alcoholic comes to you and says, I don't have any resentments, I said, you've got nothing to give away? Drink like a gentleman. My hat's off to you. You know? Or let's sit here for a while and see if maybe you haven't covered some stuff up. You know? Did the alcoholic life seem like the only normal one to you? Well, yes. Well, you know, so the life and will. The fifth step is the physical and literal turning it over. You can't do a third step without four and five. In the fifth step, you have this ceremony. It's a ceremony. It's a righteous secret ceremony that goes along with the secret handshakes and the special underwear that we have. You know? Oh, you didn't know about that? Ask me after the meeting. That's level two. The sixth and seventh step, in the big book, it's two paragraphs. Literally, everything else that Wilson wrote after that was about character defects, was about instincts run wild. It's about who we are. That's all the 12 and 12 is. Somehow he turned every step into his character defects, you know. And he exposed himself to us. So I suspect that those character defects, we're going to spend the rest of our lives confronting them through the experiences that we have, through interaction with other human beings. We don't solve the character defect problem in steps 6 and 7. That's strictly preparatory. We become willing and we ask, and then we wait. In the eighth step, we make a list of the people that we've injured and harmed in several different categories, emotional, financial, sometimes both, sexual, anybody that we've harmed. Mostly you can find those character defects and those harms in the resentment list. In the fourth column, there's all my faults and mistakes. It's pretty clear the pattern in your life. I did one when I was 10 years sober, and I've done other inventories, but I did one and I read it the other day. I was showing it to a guy who was trying to get through his inventory, and I said, you know, here in the third column, you can really see how it affects, you can see what effect that all this stuff had on you. And I'm looking down my third column, and every third word was anger. And I went, my goodness, I was an angry young lad, wasn't I, you know? And you can see the patterns in your life through that. So you go about the process of making the amends. Now, when you and I walk up to somebody that we never, ever want to see again, and we make the apology, we say, you were right, I was wrong, I'm sorry for my behavior. When you turn and walk away from that experience, you're changed. It changes you right then and there. This is not a conceptual thing. It's an action-oriented thing. If you want change in your life, you have to take action. I have to take action. I have to get in the car. I have to be in uncomfortable places. If I'm going to evolve, I have to have new experiences, not the same old ones over and over and over. Nothing happens when that happens. 10, 11, and 12, we spend the rest of our lives doing. The 11th step is the great journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's getting close to whatever it is that saved our lives. Because I don't know about you, but sometime in March of 1985, something entered my life and it saved my life. I'm pretty conscious of the fact that my life got saved. Something happened. And every single one of us at some point in time is going to have to ask themselves, why was I saved? What's the purpose of this? Why was I saved? If I get on my knees and I ask God for help, I should not send him away when he shows up. And when he shows up, which I believe he does, or she, or whatever you want to call it, it's not going to look like Mary Magdalene. It's not going to look like Jesus. It's not, some of you look like Jesus, but, you know, it's going to look a lot like you. You're going to be the messenger. You are how he works in my life. I cannot recover without you. It's impossible. I can't recover without the interaction between you and I. I've had some experiences in AA, and I believe how the character defects get approached and dealt with. You want to deal with your character defects? Sponsor people. You'll run into every one of them. Don't believe the lie that you can do other things, therefore you don't have to sponsor people. Don't believe the lie that there are many forms of 12-step work. There's only one. There's a lot of activities. There's a lot of fun stuff. But there's only one real action-oriented thing that will change our lives. Working the steps that I just described, steps 1 through 9, are about 20% of the program. It's Sober 101. It's the preparatory work for the real work. It's the beginner's class. We have a tendency to make a great big deal out of it because we're going through it, and it is a big deal. But once you're done with it, what are you going to do? Do it over and over and over again, looking for renewal? If you're sitting out there today and you're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years sober and you don't feel connected, it's because you're not. It's not a deep, profound, neurotic problem. You don't feel connected because you're not doing it. Now, even when you're depressed, if you're connected, you know you're connected. I've been depressed. I've been on interferon. I've been sick. And I know I'm connected because you people will not leave me the hell alone. I'm so goddamn connected I can't get away from you. I have to go to meetings just to get you off my back. You call me up and you say, well, how you doing, Bill? And you go, actually, I don't feel very good. And then you interrupt me and talk about yourself. You're insensitive. You don't really care about me, and you love me incorrectly. Consistently incorrectly. But I know I'm connected. I know that you're a part of my life. I used to stand up here at these podiums and I'd say that if you were on medication, you weren't sober. You know why I said that? Because I heard some of you say that. And I wanted to be a right-wing, badass AA dude. It's the old biker in me, you know. I'm looking for the right-wing, badass, fundamentalist, tough guys, you know. Those tough guys are the ones that are really incredibly worried about how the meetings are run. When all you have in your life is meetings, it becomes critical as to how the meetings are run and who is in the meetings and who should be and who shouldn't be. And those people, we all know who they are. Because I'm going to the meetings looking to get something out of it. It's my lifeline, is the meetings. When I'm going to those meetings to add something to it, I could give a shit how the meetings are run. Because I'm looking for you. And I know that the real healing and recovery comes in the basement of my house. When you and I are alone, when we're sharing each other's lives, that's when you and I save each other's lives. So I used to rant about people on medication aren't sober. And then this guy walked up to me and he said, I need some help. Will you be my sponsor? I should tell you that I'm bipolar and I'm on medication. And I went, oh, geez, one of these losers. But I've been taught something. You don't ever say no. When you get on your knees and you ask God for help, you never send him away. And that's how he talks to me. He sends me you. Sometimes he sends you me, which is really interesting, you know. But he always sends you to me. You come to me. You walk up to me. You talk to me. You interject yourself into my life. So I can't say no, but I figured maybe I could fix him, you know. So I started reading the book with this guy, and I had the experience of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him off the floor. One time he walked across the living room of my house, my wife was there, and he crawled up in my lap and curled up in a fetal position, put his head in my neck, and started sobbing like a baby. Karen walked through the living room and went, whoa. I mean, that'll get your attention. This is a grown man. This is a 40-year-old man. He was hurting. He hurts inside. He's not getting away with anything, you know? So now when I see him come and I look at him, I go, have you taken your medication? Because you're sick, man. Jesus. So I had an opinion, right? Then I had an experience. And it changed my opinion. Another promise I'll make to you. If you open your heart to this work, and it's the only work there is. It's all there is. There is nothing else. It's real simple. This is it. This is why we were saved. This is what we're here for. Should everybody sponsor? Absolutely. The reason you make up excuses for people not to sponsor is because you're trying to help them not be uncomfortable. Stop trying to save them. You know? We're supposed to be uncomfortable. Recovery by its very nature is uncomfortable. All this stuff is uncomfortable. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. It's real. It's human. It's intimate. It's strong and it's powerful. It's much more vibrant and vivid than any drug you ever took, any alcohol you ever drank. And it has long-lasting effects. The withdrawal from it is deadly, you know. I mean, it's real life. It's the real stuff. I had this guy walk up to me and he asked me to sponsor him. And he said, you know, I should tell you that I'm gay. And I said to him, well, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? He looked right at me and he said, no, I don't have any problem being gay. I have an issue with drinking, however. And I thought, yeah, right. I had forgotten, yeah. Sometime later, I said to this same man, how come you never go to gay meetings? He looked right at me, he goes, I'm going to tell you this one more time. You know? Where else are we going to learn about other cultures, other societies, how other people live and what's going on? I don't need to identify with you. You don't need to identify with me. I'll sponsor anybody. I'll never say no to anybody. A woman came up to me and she said, this woman asked me to sponsor her. She says she's a cocaine addict and I've never done cocaine. So I told her, no, what do you think? And I said, well, she probably didn't have any problem doing cocaine. That probably wasn't her issue. She was probably looking for some recovery. And I think you know something about recovery. And now you're never going to learn about cocaine addiction because you sent her away. Maybe you need to hang on to me for a while till you find the right person. How could I possibly say no to you under any conditions? How could I turn you away when I've opened my heart? Is it true that I want the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to always be there and for that I am responsible? Or is it not true? You know, I don't have to know what you went through to know how you feel. I now sponsor some guys. I sponsor one guy that was born a month after I got sober. One of the promises I think I told you, if you have any kind of prejudice at all, it'll come across the room and ask you for help. If you want to hang on to that prejudice, stay away from it. Keep it across the room. Keep it way over there so that you can continue to point at it and think you know what it is. and you've justified the prejudice. As soon as it walks into your sphere of influence, into your life, you find yourself in it. It's very disconcerting. Very disconcerting. It's uncomfortable. It is awakening. I think what happens to us when we get sober is that we are awakened. When we get married, we are awakened also. From a long slumber, you know. When we get sober, we're awakened. And the psychic change that's talked about in the book that comes after the ninth step is that awakening transforms into awareness over a period of time to where we can actually watch ourselves move through life. And these things that I hang on to, these little prejudices, these things, they become ugly in my vision. I don't like them. I walked around a long time, 6'5", 280, leather crap chains and clip-on earring, and walking around acting like a tough guy. I didn't smile very much. You know, I can be loud and overbearing. Some people say I'm a bit arrogant. I don't know where that comes from, but, you know. And I have issues with my size and my verbosity and all this stuff. And I came to a realization with the help of my cruel sponsor that, you know, if I want people in my life, I have to be inviting. I have to smile more. I've got to be accessible. I've got to be soft and open and loving and caring. And that's what will enter into my life if I behave that way in the first place. When you sponsor people, you can't help but get close to them. The whole idea, the way you and I learn intimacy in here, is we practice on each other, and then we turn and we take that home, hopefully. I had a guy standing in my kitchen one time, and his mother was dying, and he gave him my phone number because he knew that that's where he'd be after he left her in the hospital. And they called. And they said, Al, you better get back here. We don't think she's going to last. And he got up to leave, but he wasn't leaving. And I knew what he wanted, and I did not want to go. I'd never seen anybody dying before. This was 20 years ago. And I was afraid, and I didn't want to go. And I came up with all kinds of excuses in my head that there's got to be limits and barriers and parameters and stuff like this. We can't go everywhere and do anything. And I looked at him. I said, do you want me to go? And he goes, would you please? Now, for some reason, they trust us more than their own family. What is that? What is that? I think it would behoove us to get close to whatever that is. So I went with him to the hospital, and I sat in the room, and it was awful. She's all hooked up and everything. It was horrible. And I sat there with him, and a feeling came over me that I have no explanation for. And the feeling was, Bill, everything's okay. There's nothing wrong here. This is not an error. This is not a mistake. This is the way it's supposed to be. You're all right. So I told Al, I got him to sit down next to me, and I said, everything's okay, Al. There's not a problem here. Just relax. And I held his hand, and we said a prayer together. And while we were praying, he had a really tight grip on my hand, and I could feel his grip relax. That's intimacy. That's an intimate act. That's an intimate thing. Sharing a time of intimacy, quietness with another human being. And I miss it all the time because I'm looking for a head rush. That's all I know. And I've come to find out that emotions are quiet and subtle, and I need to pay attention if I want to feel them, because they're not loud and overbearing. They aren't head rushes. Those are chemically induced, you know. Jumping out of an airplane is a bit of a head rush, but the human things that we're talking about, this whole intimacy thing, is very quiet. And we are the instrument that God uses. We are the messengers of God. We are how He works in Alcoholics Anonymous. You and I are in an organization where people's lives are saved every day. And the vehicle that is used to save those lives is us. There's somebody out there waiting for you. They need to hear the words that come out of your mouth, not out of mine. This is not a mistake. It's not an error. It's a conspiracy. I'd like to close with something that's very important to me. This is a poem that was written by Sam Shoemaker. Shoemaker was the head of the Oxford Group in the United States. And when Ebbie Thatcher came to Bill Wilson, he came from Calvary Mission, which is the mission that Shoemaker ran. And Ebby was 60 days sober. And the Oxford group boys said, all right, you're ready. Go find the worst drunk you know. And that was, of course, Bill Wilson. And Ebby went to Bill. When Bill got sober, he got real close to Sam Shoemaker. You know, some people even say that Sam acted a lot like a sponsor for Bill. Bill really listened to Sam. Sam was a very bright, vibrant, well-educated, charismatic man. And Sam wrote this poem, and it's not about AA. But you tell me if this isn't your experience of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it's not, you might want to go look for this, because it's really here. It's called I Stand by the Door. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man or woman can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they've not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. I admire the people that go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door. Or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place near enough to God to hear him and know he is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them and remember that they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them. Millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I had rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. God bless you.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.